holistic perspective, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. But the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you willing to keep yourself in the confines of your own fears and the confines of your own behavior patterns, belief systems that are really destructive or certainly do not allow for the type of happiness that all of us as human beings seek? Now, today's show, we're going to be talking about behavior patterns that definitely keep people locked in not just dysfunctional experiences, but also carry it to a very deep place of shame and unhappiness and isolation and the type of cycle that can lead to a great deal of self-destruction. And that topic today is going to be about sex addiction, particularly in gay men. And before I introduce my guest to you, who's been on the show before, I want to talk about honesty. Now, the title of this show is Tell the Truth Faster. If any of you have attended 12-step meetings, you know that there's a phrase, you're only as sick as your secrets. It's another way of saying tell the truth faster. Any of you, whether you're an addict or not, knows what it's like to have things that you're so shame-filled about, so fearful of anybody else knowing, that you will do whatever you can at all costs to keep those secrets. And what happens to those secrets as they keep building and they keep building is you start living in more fear and more isolation and more shame, and the level of intimacy becomes more and more difficult in your life. You also start contributing to physical illnesses, emotional illnesses, and then behaviors that help numb, totally numb, any of the feelings that you have and any of the truth and honesty about who you are and what you're doing. Now, my belief is who you are is different than what you're doing, that we are not our behaviors. But many of us end up defining ourselves as those behaviors and then end up with low self-esteem because we're judging ourselves as bad, as defective. And that is the cycle of any addiction, but particularly since our topic today is sex addiction, and particularly sex addiction in gay men, that's the bottom line of what we're talking about. Now, my guest today has recently published a book called Cruise Control, Understanding Sex Addiction in Gay Men. And he's somebody that I've known since 1986. In fact, I can say I knew him when, because in 1986 I was running a HIV/AIDS unit at West Covina Hospital in California and was in desperate need of someone. This is before I understood I had ADD, was in desperate need of someone to help me stay organized and take care of the office, so to speak. And my guest, Rob Weiss, was a very long story, but I won't get into it, how I ended up meeting him. It became clear he was the person to be that support for me. And Rob Weiss is somebody who has become a support for a tremendous number of people all over, for professionals as well as his clients, because his expertise has opened the door for an understanding of what sex addiction is about and how it affects the gay community. But his expertise doesn't just deal with the gay community. So Rob Weiss has been on the show before. Back in 2002, I had him on twice. We talked about his first book, Cybersex Exposed, which is about cybersex addiction. He also was on the show to talk about trauma and grief, as he had gone to New York to volunteer after 9/11 to do counseling. So I'm very pleased to say I've known Rob as long as I've known him and respect him as long as I've known him. And Rob, I really want to welcome you back to the show and congratulate you on the publication of your new book.
Thank you, Stuart. I hope you don't respect or care any less about me since I am on a cell phone and we're not going to have the best connection. But
okay.
I'll do the best that I can.
Okay, I appreciate you letting us know that. So were you able to hear everything I just said?
You know, especially the parts about how great I was, I didn't miss a word of that.
Selective listening, it's called, isn't it? Okay. We've talked, like I said, we've talked a long time, and your specialty for a long time has been sex addiction. In fact, one of the things I forgot to say is you're founder and clinical director of the Sexual Recovery Institute in Los Angeles, which is an outpatient sexual addiction treatment center. And it doesn't just deal with gay men. It deals with anyone dealing with any form of sexual addiction.
Most of our clients are not gay, actually.
Okay. So what is sex addiction? And the next part of that question is, why are you writing a book specific to gay men on this issue?
That's a good question. Well, I guess, you know, really a simple way to think about sex addiction is people who are turning to sex as a means of comforting themselves or soothing themselves. In the moment, they might think it's really exciting or wonderful, but later on, whatever they're doing sexually, they don't necessarily feel so good about. But they keep doing it anyway, and one of the hallmarks of any addiction is something that you return to over and over again despite some kind of consequence. For sex addicts, the consequences tend to be things like arrests or diseases, broken relationships, losses of jobs, things like that. But yet, you know, I've worked with men who will, you know, get arrested for hiring a prostitute on a certain street, and 2 weeks later they're back on that very same street looking for another prostitute as if they had never been arrested, because their drive to seek the sex is more important to them than their fear of harm.
Well, but you say many times in the book, and, you know, I agree with it also because it's something I've known for a long time, is that sex addiction is not about sex.
Right.
So what is sex addiction about then?
Well, they're seeking sex,
but it's really not about the sex that they're really there showing up for.
Well, I think a good way to think about it is is sort of comparing it to gambling addiction, because, you know, gambling addiction is about winning or losing. It's about staying in the game as long as you can, and gambling addicts tend to be so lost in the excitement of the possibilities of winning and the next hand and then the next hand, they're not really looking at the fact that they might lose everything they have in that game. And they're really not getting the pleasure of gambling that someone who casually might go to Vegas and lose a few quarters and come back and laughing about it, they're not in the same position as that person. I think sex addiction is exactly the same, where the person, the behavior is sex, like for the gambler, the behavior is gambling, but for the sex addict, it's more about losing yourself in fantasy, and oftentimes the people I work with spend hours and hours and hours either online or kind of cruising around various places in their cars or on foot, in endless flirtations or affairs, and all of it is really about being in the excitement and the distraction of some sexual intrigue.
But why? What are they trying to distract themselves from?
Well, I think any addict is trying to distract him or herself from feelings that they're unable to tolerate, and so they find some behavior or substance to make them feel better or distract them. You know, if you've ever been in early romance or love with someone, you know how exciting it is to think about that person and can't wait to see them again and how great that date was, or, you know, whatever that is. And that is a healthy distraction from maybe a difficult day. You start thinking about somebody that you really enjoyed being with. That's kind of what the sex addict does, only they do it 24/7. They're constantly looking for some kind of sexual or relationship distraction that keeps them from having to deal with whatever is going on in their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a lot of people who will say that behavioral things like gambling and shopping and eating and sex are not
right.
True addictions. But I know that one of the things you're really describing here in that excitement is actually a similar chemical change going on in the brain that does very similar stuff to someone who's using drugs and alcohol. Can you talk about that even these behaviors are inducing a chemical high? What's that about?
Well, I think that is actually, Stuart, you really hit on the difficulty that we have as a culture understanding behavioral addiction, because I think we've gotten to the point, although we weren't there 30 or 40 years ago, I think now our culture's at the point where we can see that if someone is putting something into their body, whether they are, you know, drinking or doing cocaine or crystal meth or whatever the drug is, that if they put this drug in their body and it produces a change, they're going to feel differently, and they might get addicted to the changes that those drugs produce or the alcohol produces. So I think our culture is at a point where we can say, okay, that substance is something that someone could be addicted to physically, and I understand why you would go back again and again and again to get whatever excitement or distraction or relaxation that drug provides. But I think we're not quite at the point where we're able to look at things like gambling or sexual behavior or eating disorders, for example, as being something other than that person being weak-willed or a bad person. You know, if he really loved his family, he wouldn't go out and do those sexual things. Or, you know, if he were just a more moral person, he wouldn't gamble all that money. I think we're kind of still stuck in that place as a culture around behavioral addictions.
In terms of moral judgment issues.
And ethics and religion and a lot of things like that get tossed in when someone is engaging in behaviors that we don't approve of.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes it harder, in a way, for that person to say, no, it's really a problem that I need help with.
Mm-hmm. So I want to remind my listeners here that this is a live call-in show, and I know that any of you listening right now are reacting to what we're talking about. And it may be a very personal reaction because you're relating to what we're talking about or will in terms of other issues we bring up in this hour. Or maybe you're upset about what we're talking about. Either way, feel free to call in and ask questions or make your own comments about this or maybe even share your own story about it. And that number in the Phoenix area is area code 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. And if you're listening via the Internet outside the Phoenix area, and I know that there are those of you who are listening because I hear from you occasionally, it's the same number, 480-949-1310. Now, Rob, getting back to this judgment of society, the moral, the ethical issues, isn't that really the cornerstone of what so many addicts, no matter what the addiction is, but in particularly something as personal and core as sex behaviors and sex addiction, that creates this kind of shame base that is so overwhelming for people that's what they're aiming at numbing for a lot of them. So talk about shame issues.
Well, Stuart, you really, I think, launched onto something that is very important, which is that I think there is kind of also a concept in our culture that, you know, psychology just kind of, or therapy, or even addictions, or the idea of them, kind of makes people not have to take responsibility for their behavior. You know, I think there's an idea that if someone says they have a sex addiction or a gambling addiction, that somehow excuses what they've been doing, that they spent the family fortune on their gambling, or that they, you know, gave their wife a disease because of their sexual behavior, that somehow they should be forgiven because they have a problem. And I think it's really important to underscore the fact that saying you have an addiction is not a release from a problem. It's actually a whole level of responsibility that the person is now taking on for their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm an addict and I admit to it, it means that I'm saying, boy, I really do have this problem. And if I'm not dealing with it, then I am responsible for any harm or problems that I cause.
It's like the difference between an excuse and an explanation. You know, it gives the foundation of an explanation, but now what are you going to be doing with that explanation? And what you're saying very clearly is personal responsibility then.
In having a diagnosis, it allows for personal responsibility. For example, if you are a diabetic and, you know, all of your life you've been weak and tired and, you know, have trouble staying awake after a meal or, you know, whatever kinds of symptoms you might have, you know, you might have in the past said, oh, my, you know, I'm just not a strong person. I don't have a strong physique. Maybe I should be exercising more. You might have gotten mad at yourself or, you know, whatever it is. But once you have that diagnosis that you need to monitor your insulin, you need to take medication, et cetera, that provides a responsibility. I can no longer walk around as that diabetic and say, well, maybe I just have a weak constitution. I then have to say, you know what, I have to take responsibility for this problem and make sure that at all times I'm aware that I have it and I eat properly and I take my insulin, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with an addiction. Once I come forward and say, you know, I think I really do have this problem, then there's a whole set of solutions like support groups, like therapy, like self-care in different ways that have to be followed through. And if I'm not following through on those things, then I really am responsible for causing the harm that might cause from not dealing with my addiction.
Mm-hmm. Now, everything we've talked about so far is in general terms about addiction itself. And everything I know that in your book, Cruise Control, actually is applicable to addicts, whether they're gay or straight or lesbian or straight women or whatever. But the book itself is actually, as I understand it, even though there's been a lot written on sex addiction since 1985 that Patrick Carnes came out?
I would say, actually, 78 was the first book by Patrick Carnes wrote the first book on sex addiction in 1978.
That was 78?
Which and later became Out of the Shadows, which is probably the premier sort of book about anyone who thinks that they might have a sex addiction problem. Dr. Carnes' book is the one that you'd read and say, oh, my God.
Well, actually, it was originally called The Sexual Addict, and I have one of those copies of it, actually.
Wow.
And then I know that it was too in-your-face, so he changed it to Out of the Shadows, from what I understand. Because I actually attended a workshop with him in Atlanta, Georgia, before I moved to Los Angeles in 1985. And it was a weekend workshop on sex addiction as a therapist I went. And it was really interesting to see that about half of the therapists that attended by the end of the weekend actually stood up and self-identified as sex addicts.
Well, therapists have problems, too.
Yes, I know. That's my point.
The good part about being a therapist, one of the good things about being a therapist, is you get to hear about the solutions first.
Right. So there has been a lot written, and I know Dr. Carnes was like at the forefront of all this and actually had to deal with a lot of the resistance in the professional community to identifying this. But yours, as I understand it, is really the first full book about focusing on sex addiction in gay men.
Isn't that sad?
It is, because that's many years. So why did you write this?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have Dr. Carnes actually write the foreword for the book, and he agreed with me that that there are certain places that gay men will go for sex, there are certain kinds of relationships that gay men engage in that are somewhat different than a heterosexual person might, and that, you know, a lot of Dr. Carnes' books, for example, might speak to someone who came into treatment because they're going to lose their wife, or because their particular family situation didn't allow them to talk about their problem. And those situations are very different for gay men, I think. What's sad to me is that, you know, Stuart, when you and I met in the early or mid-1980s, I truly believe that there were men who were being infected, and women too, with the AIDS virus or the HIV virus because there was sex addiction going on. And it's unfortunate to me that we weren't talking about this so much sooner. I really believe lives could have been saved.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But here we are, and now there's a book.
Okay. So I actually want to read a paragraph from the book, page 20, which actually talks about gay versus straight. And you wrote here, gay male sex addicts are not compulsively sexual because of their sexual orientation, but as a consequence of their individual psychological issues and neurological predisposition to addiction. This is exactly the same set of symptoms presented by straight male sex addicts. Unfortunately for the gay sex addict, his increasingly destructive patterns of sexual behavior take place against a cultural background of dramatically greater sexual freedoms than those usually enjoyed by his heterosexual peers. The urban gay man is in some ways a prisoner of his own freedoms. He has fewer opportunities for self-examination and little support for behavior change when his association to sexuality becomes obsessive.
I wrote that?
You wrote that.
Oh, that's
page 20.
I like that.
You don't remember?
No, I just like hearing it. It sounds good. You know, a prisoner of his own freedom. That's pretty good. I like that. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Well, but that's the truth, because I remember going to Minneapolis, so I think one of the first national conferences on sex addiction, and I was actually surprised to run into a fellow alumni from Harper College or SUNY Binghamton, or it's now called Binghamton University, who was actually in my graduating class. His name was Marty Levine. And Marty was there to speak as the counterpoint to what the conference was about. He was one of those gay activists. He was actually even one of the organizers of the gay student union on campus when everybody was able to come out after Stonewall. But he spoke saying that sex addiction is just another way for society to oppress gay men and take their freedoms of sexual expression away from them. And even then, I was, like, floored by what he was saying. But people are still saying that in a lot of ways.
But I think for a community that has been defined by the kind of sex that it has, to then have people come forward and say that some of that might be a problem could be very threatening, and it is understanding. I think now that, and you know, we are talking about gay men at the moment. I think now that gay men are more culturally accepted, that they have fuller lives, they have families, they have kids, they have marriage of their own, some kind of marriage of their own commitment. There's room to say, you know, we're not just defined by sex.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can say that I'm not just defined by sex, then you can say that some people have sexual problems without.
Right.
Without a whole community feeling attacked.
Right. But then you're still dealing with the residue of centuries, and particularly the most recent decades here, as we've been liberated from having to be self-defined as just sexual beings, the residue of that previous definition of we are only sexual beings. In fact, you know, the right's still trying to solely define us as such. And so a lot of people still live in communities and in a society where that's still beating them down. So I think we're just at the beginning of maybe healing that, but I think there are a lot of people out there that are still so stuck in the shame of cultural and moral and religious precepts that they are still defining themselves solely as sexual beings. But I think your point is well taken, that there's now a wider viewpoint and possibilities of defining oneself as human before just being sexual.
Well, we may be getting off into the political here, but I think that one of the challenges of any ethnic or minority community is to that's come through real struggle for recognition and equality is to then also say, but you know, we do have some problems because in the struggle for recognition and equality, you kind of have to come forward and say, we're as good as anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And then to go back and say, we're as good as anyone else, but we have problems like anyone else, can fuel people to say, well, see, I knew they were sick all along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a part of why there's been such a difficulty in talking about this.
Well, when you say that, you know, there's a sickness there, basically we're talking about the sickness of addiction in this context. And to be able to separate the fact that, you know, maybe 10%, you say in your book that 10% of gay men may be sex addicts. And, I mean, I would think that's a relatively high number compared to society in general, but when you consider what we're talking about in terms of gay men solely being defined as sexual beings and locked into the secrecy, and this is a point I make very often, that as we've been defined only as sexual beings because we have not been able to be open about relationships for so many decades, that the behaviors that we engaged in were purely sexual and then went on to intensify the level of shame and fear of being found out and the secrecy and all these other things. So, you know, we're really talking about, you know, a large percentage of gay men that are still trying to heal the impact of the negative self-esteem that's been imposed there.
As is true for almost any minority in this in our culture.
Mm-hmm. And then it's also true of any addict, no matter who they are or what their background is. It's that, again, addiction is addiction. And shame and guilt and fear of being found out is at play in any addictive process, no matter what the addiction is.
And it kind of may not make sense, but even though I wrote a book about a particular population, gay men, and how they act out sexually, I don't treat, in our treatment center, we treat both heterosexual and homosexual men in the same groups. They have the same treatment. Everything is really the same because their behaviors and their feelings about their behaviors really aren't any different. They may go to different places for sex. They may have sex with a different gender.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're an addict, you're an addict, and the outcome of that is the same for everyone.
Right. But then that gets us into, you know, I agree with you totally, because, you know, in my private practice, I deal with a lot of addictions, a lot of people who have addictions, a lot of sex addicts in particular. As you know, I work a lot with that also in my private practice. But not all of them are gay men. And there are a lot of straight men that come in for therapy who may not even identify their behavior patterns as an addictive process, you know, because, I mean, it's macho to be having as many conquests as you can. The same way with gay men, you know, people's self-esteem in the gay community is how many guys can they go to sleep with in the course of a month, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So sex addiction is something that is across the board and expresses itself in very many ways. And I'd like to talk about that, because there are a lot of people who don't understand that a lot of sex addicts are not even having sex with other people. You know, it's more about pornography or masturbation or cybersex and things like that, that it's much more of an isolated thing and not just how many partners they're having.
Well, it's because I think when I've heard people who really don't know anything about this hear the term sex addict, they say, oh, my God, that person must be having all the great, exciting sex that I would want to have.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying is true. There are a number of people that we work with, men and women, at the Sexual Recovery Institute who come in and they don't have any sex with other people. Mm-hmm. But they'll spend 3 or 4 hours a night online every night, or they'll, you know, spend hours cruising or looking for contacts. They may have very little sex, as you know, or even contact, but they lose their lives in the pursuit of the sexual act.
Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes not about the behavior in terms of the acting out. Sometimes it's a very internal thing of the obsessiveness of the thinking and the planning and the rituals around it.
Yes.
Okay? So that can be just as destructive, because even the thought process of the fantasy life takes one away from living life.
Well, one of the examples I think I draw on cruise control, and you know, I hear this among all people who sex act out, is the image of sitting across a table in a restaurant with really good friends, or with my partner or my wife or whomever that might be, and really wanting to be with them and enjoy them, but I am so drawn to look at other people's breasts or crotches or whatever that is. I'm so distracted by every single sexual image that walks by me that I'm really not able to stay present or focus on the person I'm with. And that's very typical for a sex addict, to feel like they're with people, but they're not really with people, because sex is always the pursuit of sex is always at the foremost in their mind.
But they become great actors, because a lot of people don't even realize that's going on. It's like, I know with my own ADD, when I realize that my eyes are always wandering and I'm so easily distracted, that one of the things, and I suggest this to a lot of my sex addicts too that I work with, is when you are in a restaurant with someone, be the one that sits facing the wall.
Right.
Don't be the one, because most addicts or people with ADD also will want to sit up against the wall so they can keep watching the crowd and stuff. And I found myself with the ADD, when I started sitting facing the wall, I started being more present in the conversations in the restaurant.
And you know what? Recovery and healing from addictions can be as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
It can be simple as making, first of all, having the understanding that if I'm facing the restaurant, you know, the window and the outside of the restaurant, I'm going to be looking at everyone and everything. And since my goal is to really be with this person I'm with, I don't want to even have that distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very healthy choice that someone might make. But first you have to know that it is a problem. You have to know what the problem is. You have to know that you can make a choice like that. Then you have to deal with the fact that you would much rather look at all the people walking by and realize that even though you want to, you're not going to.
Okay. So I want to do two things here. I want to talk about how does one know if they have a problem with sex addiction, and the second thing is, what do you do about it if you get to that place of assessing it? So how does one know if they're a sex addict?
Well, I think that you know you're a sex addict if you see that sex or the pursuit of sex or the thought of sex is so important to you that it takes up increasing amounts of your time, that it interferes with your relationships, that it interferes with sleep or recreation or work, that you put yourself in situations of risk or danger or harm to something important to you because of the pursuit of sex, and you do it anyway. I think you know you're a sex addict if you have tried to say, I'm going to do less of this or not go to these places or whatever that is that you do, and you find yourself unable to change your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
One way for anyone to determine, one very simple test of whether you have any kind of addiction, whether it's alcohol or drugs or gambling or sex, or is to say, I'm going to take, oh, I don't know, let's say 30 days and not do that. You know, for a sex addict, it would be, I'm not going to have sex with anyone for 30 days, or even myself. For a gambler, it might be, I'm not going to do any kind of gambling, not even buy a lottery ticket for 30 days. And that's a really good measure. If that person can say, I can actually follow through on that, then they're less likely to be someone who really has an addiction.
Or they have something to prove, and they white knuckle it for 30 days just to be able to justify the fact that they're not an addict, and then they go right back to the behaviors again.
That could happen, and then they have to look at, you know, why did I stop, and, you know, how did I feel when I was, you know, it's all a learning experience.
Right. And I had a client a few years ago who clearly identifies as a sex addict. In fact, the sponsor had actually referred him to me, and his main thing was porn on the computer. And when he finally got to the point where he says he has to stop this, and it was affecting his relationship with his lover, you know, he said he was willing to give up the floppy disks that he had put all of these photos that he had downloaded from the internet. Now, this is someone who was even doing it at work in a law office, which was putting his job at risk because he was actually caught a couple of times and reprimanded. But when he finally was willing to give it up, I said, bring them in here, turn them over to somebody.
Uh-huh.
And I was shocked when he actually brought in two full grocery bags filled with these floppy disks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were organized, and they were labeled, and they were categorized, and it was like the amount of time and energy spent on doing that kind of organization and finding the photos and the level of grieving he went through after he turned these things over to me was amazing. So what about the grief of changing behaviors? How do people deal with that?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think grief is the right word, but I don't know that people know that they're grieving when they
mm-hmm.
make these kind of changes. I just think that they really struggle to want to return to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the first things that I see and many of us see when we're asking someone to change a behavior that they know is a problem but they don't really want to
mm-hmm.
is anger. You know, I often have clients come in and say, I don't want to have this problem. I don't want to have these issues. I want to be able to do what I want to do. You know, and they really are, as you said, grieving and struggling with that they have to let go of something that has been a major component of their life as long as they can remember.
Right. And if numbing emotions is one of the main drivers of addiction, then they need to be looking at it in terms of grief because they need some help in learning how to grieve in a healthy way and how not to be afraid of their grief and to someone who can help them walk through it.
Well, one of the things I try to say in Cruise Control, and I think it's true for any addiction, is that you can't recover alone. And even though you may recognize the problem and you may have a sincere desire to deal with it, a sex addict or any addict really needs other people to depend on for accountability, for support, for direction. You know, a professional therapist is helpful, but it doesn't have to be that. It could be a 12-step program or people in one. You know, some people actually get support online,
mm-hmm.
people who live in rural areas and that kind of thing. But I have not experienced anyone yet who truly had an addictive behavior that was able to just stop on their own, no matter how much they wanted to. People really need help.
Well, the people are saying, well, you know, equating doing it on their own as strength and asking for help as weakness. And those are the people that say, well, I can do this on my own. I don't need any help, until they're either arrested or their lover's walking out on them or something is forcing them, even reluctantly, to finally seek help.
Well, the thing about
what do people do when they want to get some help?
Well, I was just going to say briefly that it's interesting because if you are an addict and you really, really, really try to stop and you really, really can't, you're right, Stuart. It's the consequences of not being able to stop that drive people to seek help. In other words, I think that no matter how much you may not want help, if you don't get it eventually, the trouble you get in is going to lead you to having to get it, whether you like it or not.
Right.
So what was your question about stopping?
The question was, what are the options out there? You've mentioned therapy, you've mentioned 12-step meetings and other things, but get more specific about this in terms of what people can do in terms of mm-hmm. when they finally get to the point of saying, I do need help, and it's scary and it's frightening, but I need to turn somewhere. Where do they turn? What do they do? And what are the options out there for people?
Well, I think it's a very good question because and this is not to dismiss or devalue my own profession, but sex addiction is a very specific kind of disorder that needs to be treated by people like yourself who understand what to do with it. And so I have worked with many, many people who have gone to a counselor in their community and said, I have this problem, and the counselor may have been understanding or supportive, but really didn't know how specifically to help that person. And in a way, it's kind of like, you know, someone who has a lung disorder, and they go to their general practitioner. Well, that general practitioner may be able to identify it, but they need to go to a pulmonary specialist if they're going to deal with their lung disorder. And it's really the same addiction. You have to find someone who understands addiction and knows how to treat it to get the proper kind of help.
Okay, so that means finding the right therapist. So let's talk about therapists first, and then I want to get into, like, group therapy and 12-step meetings and, you know, other things that people can do. How do you find the right therapist?
Well, there is a national organization for sex addiction. It's called the Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health, SASH. And online, sash.net, sash.net, there is that organization has access to articles, information, therapists who are skilled in these areas, treatment centers, 12-step meetings on a national level. So I think finding a good place to start would be finding something like that, like a nonprofit or general organization that really understands how to treat these issues and where you can go to look for help. I think if you just go online Google or type in a search for sex addiction treatment, you're going to find some answers there. But, you know, the primary thing that I think everyone who might think they have a problem like this should do is educate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether my book or other books on the subject, go to Amazon or some bookseller and type in sex addiction and see if you can find some books that would really help you understand whether you have a problem or not and if you can and where and how to get help.
And so reading and education is an important thing. Now, there are some people that are still so frightened that someone may find out that, you know, it's like the old days when you were afraid to go into a pharmacy and buy condoms or, you know, buy any kind of porn and stuff. There are people who are going to be afraid to walk up to the cash register with a book called Cruise Control, you know,
well, this
or
Out of the
Shadows.
So this is the great thing about the Internet, which is
exactly,
that you can go
that's
online.
Where I was going. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, because the Internet, including the website for the Sexual Recovery Institute, is a good resource. So talk about your website for a minute.
Well, we try very hard. Our website is sexualrecovery.com, and we've just tried very, very hard to not just focus on what we do. We're trying to bring people in to see us, because people live all over the country, they live all over the world, they have all kinds of financial situations. Not everyone can come to a therapy center in Los Angeles, but although you're certainly welcome. But the site has an enormous number of articles, books to read, support groups, other therapists to see around the country. I mean, we really work hard at making information and resources available to people.
And so that they could get links actually to other things in their area, or even the link to SASH and other things from what I've seen on your website.
Yeah.
So education is the first step, okay? In other words, education will help lay a foundation for the reality that what you're dealing with. It will also give you some of the information you need that when you're actually shopping around for a therapist, to ask the right questions of that therapist.
That's correct.
And it's very important. I've said this many times. To interview potential therapists. Don't just automatically assume that, you know, the one you're going to is the one you have to stay with, but to ask the right questions. What's their background and experience in dealing with sex addiction? What is, you know, how much time have they spent working with gay men so that you're not getting a homophobic therapist? You know, all these sort of things are very important.
One thing that very helps, I think treatment for any addiction, if someone is in a therapy setting, is most helpful if it involves some kind of group. So, and groups are also less expensive. So if you can find some place, wherever you are, that offers a group for sex addicts or even just for addicts, that's a step ahead of someone who then finding a therapist who maybe doesn't work with groups or understand groups. I think group treatment is very helpful. And, for example, we run 8 groups a week, and that's simply because that, you know, when you are, if you have a problem, you can stand across the desk from a therapist, or sit, I should say, and talk about your problem and maybe feel understood or supported, but that's not the same thing as being in a room with other people who have the same problem who aren't embarrassed to talk about it. That's very freeing and supportive.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of group, though, you're talking about group therapy. Now, there's also 12-step meetings that you've mentioned. There's Sexual Compulsives Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous, Sexaholics Anonymous. You know, there are a lot of different names for these groups, but there are a lot of people who are very resistant. They think of a lot of the myths about 12-step groups. You know, it's a cult, it's about religion. How do you help people address that? Because I know it's one of the biggest problems I have with certain clients about getting them in the door to that first 12-step meeting.
Yeah. Well, I think there are a number of ways to address people's feelings about 12-step meetings. I mean, one of them is that with a sex addict, for example, they'll often say things like, well, I don't want to be seen going to one of those meetings with all those other people with sexual problems, because what if somebody sees me there?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my response is, well, what if somebody saw you picking up a prostitute? What if somebody saw you in a bathhouse? In other words, it's interesting to me that sometimes people, when they're not acting out their addiction, become very, very concerned about their reputations and how they might be seen, but when they're actually in it, they could care less. And the truth is that if you are in a 12-step support group and you run into someone else that you know there, they have just as much to hide as you do.
And probably will feel relieved that they've finally broken the ice and that somebody that knows them finally sees them. There's a certain level of that honesty that comes with recognizing one another, and maybe it becomes the beginning of a familial support system.
There's also the issue of, you know, this is a cult. It's a religion, you know, all of the other concerns that people have about going to some kind of support group like that. And, you know, what I would say to that is one of the mainstay slogans or sayings in all of the 12-step programs, whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous or Sexaholics Anonymous or Gamblers Anonymous, whatever it is, one of the main sayings that you hear is take what you like and leave the rest. And I really like that, because what it says is I can go into one of those places and I can see if there's anything there for me that I can gain from or grow from, which usually there's something. And if I'm really uncomfortable with something that someone's talking about or the way something's addressed, I could just say, well, I won't pay any attention. That part I don't have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good way to start it with a kind of open mind.
Right.
The other thing I was going to say is that, you know, you can be resistant to a 12-step program, but the truth is that they do work. And if you are involved and make it a priority, and sometimes it's more important. Sometimes people have pushed themselves through those resistances or difficulties in wanting to do those things because they need to find another choice, and what they're doing isn't working.
Mm-hmm. And I have a client that I'm working with right now who a few months ago, when he was in enough pain, finally, you know, went with a suggestion that I have of getting himself 86th is the term, but put on the list at all the bathhouses locally that he cannot enter anymore. But he also was really resistant about 12-step programs, and he really shocked me about 2 weeks ago when he came in and he said he found a Saturday meeting that he actually liked and felt comfortable with. And it's like he couldn't understand what finally motivated him to try one more meeting. because for a year he's been resistant about 12-step meetings. Mm-hmm. But I think it's about shopping around, because don't judge all 12-step meetings by one or two experiences.
You know? And I want to say that is not the only way to get well. You know, people find all kinds of means and ways to mm-hmm. heal from their disorders. The thing about 12 steps is that they're free and they're everywhere, unless you live in a rural area. And this is true for sex addiction as well now. Mm-hmm. And there are other people there who are dealing with what you're dealing with, and that can be helpful.
Right. Now what's the difference between inpatient and outpatient work?
Well, some people are having so much trouble in their lives, whether they're feeling that they don't want to live or they can't live with the consequences they're having, or they just cannot stop dangerous or problematic sexual behaviors, no matter how much support they get from a therapist. They might need to be in some kind of treatment center where they can be safe, and they're going to be have a place where everyone around them is supporting the change and that they're trying to make and help them to grow. Other people may not be as desperate about their feelings about themselves, or they may be able to get a better handle on their behaviors by simply seeing a therapist or joining a group, and those people would be more better served in an outpatient setting.
Okay, so there is options for people, just like with drug addiction. In fact, a lot of the inpatient drug abuse programs actually are dealing with the dual diagnosis or the dual addiction issue, and are helping people deal with once they take away. I mean, we didn't even talk about the gay community and the crystal use and stuff like that, and how connected the sex addiction and the crystal addiction is. Talk about that for a minute, because I think it's like at the cornerstone of a lot of issues right now.
Well, there is a chapter in Cruise Control about crystal meth, drugs, and sex addiction, and it had to be in there because there are people who, because of their drug use, they end up engaging in very compulsive sexual behaviors. There are other people who, because of their sexual behavior, end up using drugs because of where they go to have sex. And sometimes those two are fused together and sometimes they're not. I work with men who have long histories of sexual acting out or sexual addiction in various ways, and then they find crystal meth or they find drugs and they become hooked on both of them together. Their sexual behavior becomes something they do when they're high.
Mm-hmm.
What can be difficult for those men if they stop getting high is that sex can be kind of boring without all those drugs and excitement.
Right. And that's an issue that comes up quite frequently. Even though sex may have been exciting to them before they got into the crystal, there is now this accentuated high that comes with sex with the crystal, and they need to deal, just like anything else, how do I live a life that is different than what I was living? I mean, that's what change is about. And everything
that's
we're talking about right now is about change and coping with change and reinforcing change.
Well, that's one of those, it sounds simple, but it's actually difficult,
mm-hmm.
which is, I want to stop having the problems that I'm having. I don't want to be arrested. I don't want to get a disease. I don't want to lie to my partner. But I don't want to stop what I've been doing, which
mm-hmm.
is actually kind of fun, and I like it.
Right.
And so there is a difference between not wanting to have
Not wanting to have what?
Consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And not wanting to stop the behavior.
Well, there's also about the getting to the truth, telling the truth faster. Has this really been fun? Do you really like it? Because most of the time, as we've been saying this whole hour, is by the time people are getting to therapy, it's no longer fun, and they're not really liking it. It's not giving them the same feeling it did at the beginning, and now they're getting to the point where they're realizing the consequences and the destructiveness of the behavior.
I think there's a saying that goes something like, people change when the pain of what they've been doing is greater than the pain of change. And I think that's what we're talking about, is that someone's sexual behavior has to become so painful for them that they are willing to change despite the challenges that change involves. I do want to say something, though, about men who have sex with men and think that they are sex addicts. So there is a category of men who I see in treatment that are in heterosexual marriages. They may love a woman. They may have a family, and they secretly go out and have sex with men.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those men really do have a great attraction to men, but they don't want to really acknowledge or admit it to themselves. And so they kind of come in and say, listen, I'm a sex addict, and I know that because I'm attracted to men. And if I just wasn't attracted to men or didn't want to have sex with men anymore, then I wouldn't be having problems with my sex addiction anymore. And
mm-hmm.
sex addiction treatment is not going to change someone's interest, sexual interests.
Right.
It's not going to change their feelings about sex. Sex addiction treatment is going to help them with having to lie and keep secrets and get into trouble with their sexual behavior. But sex addiction treatment is not a cure for homosexuality. And some people kind of come in hoping that that would be the case.
Right.
And that's a hard thing to come to terms with.
Well, but it's not always about the fact that, because I had one client a number of years ago who was very happily married and had a kid and was very, I mean, his sex life with his wife was very eroticized and things like that, but when he acted out, he clearly identified as a sex addict. When he acted out, it was always with men, not with other women. On the computer, masturbating, or even when mm-hmm. he met someone in person, it was with a man. And maybe that's classified as bisexual, and he needed to come to terms with that. But the issue really was not as much his attraction to other men, but his behaviors outside his committed relationship that he really was committed to.
I'm really glad you said that, Stuart, because I think that helps a lot with an understanding of that sex addiction is not about where you go for sex. It's not about who you have sex with. Because certainly I as a therapist, and I know you don't really have any say on what someone does or doesn't do that brings them pleasure or makes them happy. But if what they're doing causes them to have more problems than it does benefits, then we do have to help them to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one struggle that I find all addicts actually have, but I think this is a good way to say it, is that sex addicts that I work with who have to stop certain behaviors, like looking at pornography, for example, will feel a great sense of unfairness about this. Like, how come other guys get to look at pornography and they don't have a problem and I do?
It's not fair.
And it's not fair. And you know what? It isn't fair, because just like there are many people who can drink alcohol and get drunk once in a while and you know, celebrate at a wedding, and they don't have a problem with it. But there are certain people, when they start drinking, that their lives become a wreck. And those people, fair or not, really can't drink. And it's the same with a sex addict. There are certain people who can do whatever they want sexually, and it doesn't cause them to have problems because they can stop at any time, and they don't go beyond certain limits, and it's something they enjoy. Other people get involved in certain kinds of sexual behaviors, and it starts to destroy their lives. And you know what? That's kind of just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, Rob. And on page 147, you have a key to maintaining change. And I know that we haven't even got into the issues of relapse slipping and things like that, which is relevant to all addicts who are in recovery. But I think it's important that people who are listening to this have a sense of hope that when you go to 12-step meetings, one of the things that 12-step meetings give you is a chance to meet people who have some time behind them of recovery, that you see that it's possible and that it's hopeful. But you list here the key to maintaining change. As any successfully recovering addict will tell you, the keys to changing addictive behavior are quite simple. Number one, acceptance of your problem. Number two, initial motivation to change. Number three, willingness to ask others to help you. Number four, staying motivated. And five, accountability. You go on to say, those who are committed to avoiding a return to their sexual acting out will tolerate rituals and situations that are sometimes annoying and unfamiliar, experiment with uncomfortable and difficult feelings, and make themselves accountable to people they barely know. They're willing to take this arduous path because they don't want to continue to suffer from an active addiction that shapes their lives. And I think that is an important thing to end today's discussion on. And we didn't even get into relationships that are dealing with sex addiction and things like
mm-hmm.
that. And I'd love to have you back to talk about that very soon.
Thank you, Stuart.
And I really want to thank you for taking time on your Saturday to talk about this, and I wish you lots of luck with the new book, and I really encourage people, if they want to get a copy of the book, they could go to sexualrecovery.com, they could go to my site, tellthetruthfaster.com, and I'm assuming it's on Amazon?
It is on Amazon.
Okay.
So again, Rob, thank you. I'm sorry we have to rush to go. I want to thank all of you for listening, and you can hear this show repeated on the archives in a couple of weeks at tellthetruthfaster.com. This is Stuart Altshuler on KXAM 1310 AM in Phoenix, wishing you all a great weekend.